ambassadors, you know, local, down at the local level. Everybody did a great job. We're all doing a great job. Really? So if we're doing such a great job, why does it feel like we're losing?
Michael Flynn was, you know, just unsparing in his criticism of how the war was going. Then we found out that Flynn was only one of hundreds of people who had been interviewed by this Inspector General for Afghanistan over the previous few years. So we thought, well, we want to see what everybody else had to say about the war.
That was the Washington Post's Craig Whitlock talking about the impetus of the Afghanistan Papers, which is a compendium released today of more than 400 interviews that the government conducted with various people, including Michael Flynn, who you heard of at the top, conducted and then suppressed as part of an internal review on how America's longest war went so horribly wrong. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I'm Matt Welch, joined as ever by my colleagues Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Good morning, peeps.
Howdy.
Hey, happy Monday.
So after 9/11, the U.S. overthrew the Taliban-controlled government of Afghanistan, which had shielded Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda, who had perpetrated that terrible act. Since that moment of victory, more than 2,300 U.S. service members have been killed during the ensuing occupation. Here is one 2015 quote from the Afghan war czar during both the Bush and Obama administrations, a guy by the name of Douglas Lute. He said, "We were devoid of a fundamental understanding of Afghanistan. We didn't know what we were doing. What are we trying to do here? We didn't have the foggiest notion of what we were undertaking. If the American people knew the magnitude of this dysfunction, trails off, 2,400 lives lost, who will say this was in vain?" That is a representative quote. This report just dropped this morning, so we haven't had a full time to digest the whole thing. I've read about half of it, but I wanted to get just from each of you kind of one big takeaway that you had from reading this. Catherine, why don't you go first?
Yeah, I mean, I read it partially as a document of the ineptitude of large organizations. And one thing that was striking to me about it was how a lot of the quotes, if you took out the proper nouns, could basically be what you would get if you interviewed almost anyone about any large enterprise that had like come down from the top and that maybe the people on the ground were not fully on board with or didn't fully understand the reason for having received those orders. So part of me, I guess, felt that the takeaway was not this war is especially bad or was conducted especially ineptly, but actually that all wars are probably like this. Certainly the echoes with the Pentagon Papers were extremely noticeable and cultivated by the Washington Post in their presentation. But maybe actually all big enterprises are stupid, and especially those that the government does, and especially war.
And Nick, I'd ask you to expand on that, maybe even with a lens of like, yes, it's presented as a Pentagon Papers thing, but the Pentagon Papers kind of jerked people's necks around into a conclusion that maybe they weren't having yet. And this feels like it just kind of confirms what we all know. What was your big takeaway?
I think you're right about that. I would disagree that, you know, the United States has prosecuted wars that have been successful, and World War II is the clearest example of that, precisely because there was a shared, defined, articulated goal that everybody agreed on. And that's, you know, you can have a concerted effort that actually works towards a particular goal. And war is one of the easier things for government or anybody to undertake in terms of if you know what victory looks like from the beginning. And I think this comes through in the documents, or at least the stuff that I looked at in the Washington Post and a couple of other places, which is that after the Taliban, and as you mentioned, Matt, 6 months in, we had chased al-Qaeda out of Afghanistan and had essentially broken the back of them as a terrorist network. And then it's like, what do you do next? And nobody had any idea. I think Reason and other people were criticizing the war effort back then in real time because nobody could define what the mission was or even what victory looked like. And as a result, you know, we're still there. And it's the same thing. And for me, that's the big takeaway, which is that we seem to not have this you know, this ability to understand what works and what doesn't. And that's independent of whether or not we should have been in Afghanistan or certainly Iraq, where you could chalk up a similar kind of outcome. The good news about Iraq is that we kind of got out of that, although not tremendously.
There was a quote in here from James Dobbins, from a former diplomat, that really struck me. It was, "We don't invade poor countries to make them rich. We don't invade authoritarian countries to make them democratic. We invade violent countries to make them peaceful, and we clearly failed in Afghanistan." And the levels of, like, that seems like a very simple and straightforward claim, but of course we do invade authoritarian countries to make them democratic, or at least that's sometimes one of our goals. We arguably have made the claim that we are, helping poor countries by invading them as well. And I think that's part of the problem, is even people who feel like they could confidently say what our goals were oversimplifying and often wrong.
Well, this is always the case with a large-scale war effort.
A large-scale anything effort, though. This is my
thing. But in particular, a large-scale war effort requires...
Seriously, like the first Gulf War had a clear objective, which was to kick the Iraqis out of Kuwait. And that happened. I mean, that was... you know, clearly defined and delimited. And again, I don't think we should have invaded, or that George H.W. Bush should have done that. But if there is a specific goal that is achievable, it can be met. It's almost never wise to go into war. But I think what we're learning here also, and Matt, to go to your question of what's the big takeaway, the other thing that is amazing is that Obama came in so much later. And he did not say, okay, we're done here, let's get out. He intensified, he created a surge, and that nobody knew what it was supposed to be doing. And when you read the comments on that, you realize this is a bipartisan, or this is a Washington consensus fuck up. And that is truly, truly terrifying.
Yeah, the surge, which he campaigned on, right? He said, we're against dumb wars, but the smart one really is in Afghanistan.
I don't think, but he didn't, did he actually say, and I'm going to triple existing troop strength in Afghanistan during the campaign? He was working the territory.
He campaigned on the surge. He campaigned on the surge, for sure. And you're right. It is absolutely bipartisan. And when he announced the surge, he did so by also saying, and we're also going to withdraw our troops in like 18 months. So we're searching, and then here's the date that we're leaving, and none of it made sense. And it was passed off as like, that's the act of a wise man. Suderman, what's your takeaway from this?
That large-scale war efforts, like I said, typically require multiple justifications, because that's how you build the political coalition that is necessary to support such an effort. Different people have different reasons, and that makes the objectives of such efforts kind of inherently vague or diffuse. The other thing that I would say is that it's important to remember that this is what the government does all the time when projects even that sort of nominally go right, but certainly with projects that don't go well, they lie to people. They just flat out lie. They spin the message. They exaggerate. They just pretend they don't have numbers they do have, or they give you numbers that they know are taken wildly out of context. And I would point you back to the launch of Obamacare's exchanges in 2013 when the memos came out. The memos came out after the first, the thing went online and it was very clearly not working. And people started to realize, this thing is not just like, it's over. First, they were like, it's overloaded because people are so interested in it. And then after the days and weeks went on and it still wasn't working at all. And you had all of these reports of the signup centers, people who were motivated to make this thing work, to say it was working well. The folks who were employed at those signup centers were saying, we cannot get people through the system at all. And it came out later that there were internal memos where they signed up a total of six people, on the first day, something like 248 on the second day. And this whole time HHS is saying publicly, well, yes, we believe there's there's very intense interest, but the system is working. The system is online and ready to go. And in fact, what had happened was they had launched based on a target date that they thought that if they didn't have effectively a pretend launch, that the political pressure to just shut down the whole thing and kill the whole law, delay it for another year, which would end up sort of creating a cycle of delays, would just kill the whole thing. And so they launched a website and a backend that they knew didn't really work at all, and then pretended it did and got away with it for at least several weeks and arguably for several months as the press, you know, sort of became more skeptical.
Arguably for several years, because Obamacare is still with us and there is still a website. So
there is
win.
Still a website.
They win.
It is, although, and in fact, I mean, it functions well enough at this point, but a bunch of the functionality that they said was going to be built in on day one never got built. And it took years for them to complete that back end project that they said, oh, it's totally on track. It's totally going to be ready. We've got this under control. You know, I mean, I was writing skeptical pieces for at least 6 months, if not a year, before the thing launched, because there were signs that it was not going well, even in the public press. But HHS kept denying it. I had HHS reps telling me, you know, everything's going fine. Yes, there's the usual technical hiccups that go with any large scale enterprise software project, but nothing abnormal. This thing is going to work. It does work. It didn't.
Which is the same thing that's in these Afghanistan papers, to yep. bring us back to the topic. Like, there really is this just incredible, you know, the people in these interviews are being very candid, and, you know, their names were redacted in some cases, even in this release, though it looks like the Washington Post managed to figure out who a bunch of them were, and they did release some of the names. The fact, though, that even these very savvy, high-level operators were willing to do obtainable voice recordings in some cases that were so blunt is kind of shocking, because these are people who mostly, I think, drink their own Kool-Aid, who are the ones in charge of doing the double speak to the public. And that's the thing that was the most striking to me. These are people who were saying to the public, everything is fine. You know, the Obamacare exchanges and the Afghan war are going great. And then saying to the folks doing this investigation, oh my God, everything is a disaster. What are we going
to
do?
I think a good lesson here also to pull away from all of this stuff is the forced transparency. I mean, it's an interesting story how the Washington Post had to sue in order to get access to these records and publish them and whatnot. And it's really good on them. But, you know, again and again, you see whether it's through WikiLeaks and it's the DNC emails or earlier, under Chelsea Manning, kind of diplomatic chatter and background conversations, this stuff is going to come out. And it always, you know, it, we can just skip the, one of the things that we should be doing and we should be kind of encouraging is to skip the bullshit stage and just have people being more honest and upfront, you know, from day one, because it is striking when you look at the baldness of the statements of absolute chaos and failure from people who then are talking to the public and saying, no, you know, actually everything is going really well. That gap is going to be shrinking to a point where it's really, hopefully it'll be revealed in real time. But we can just get through a lot of that, and we should now more than ever.
By the way, my other quick takeaway here is that Rumsfeld continues to be like the recent political history's most likable supervillain. Like he maybe I should have known this before, but
I didn't know that his
little memos were called snowflakes, which is like an incredibly evocative, like he's just he's like drifting down these like one or two sentence, these short hit memos multiple times a day. And they're stuff like, I have no visibility into who the bad guys are. We are woefully deficient in human intelligence. And the fact that he's just writing that stuff down, and my recollection is, was like actually saying that stuff in press conferences sometimes too. You know, there's something, I found something refreshing, even in this quite blunt series of statements and documents, about Rumsfeld's real-time bluntness about how things were not going well.
Someone on Twitter.
We interviewed Errol Morris, who did a documentary about Donald Rumsfeld. And in that, you know, and it's a long interview with Rumsfeld. Rumsfeld is a supervillain in all of this, because he did, in many cases, he was just talking up openly and publicly about stuff. But he charmed all of the Pentagon reporters. He charmed the press, you know, by seemingly to be accessible and to be refreshing.
Me.
And he absolutely, absolutely monstrous. And I think he more than, you know, when you look at people like Flynn or some of the other, like Lutz and some of the other people named in this, they knew what reality was and then lied about it publicly. I think Rumsfeld is the guy who drank his own Kool-Aid, got high on his own supply, and that perpetuated a real problem. I mean, he eventually got kicked out of the Bush administration, but he is, if it had been somebody else in charge then, this we might not still be in Afghanistan.
It was pointed out to me this morning on Twitter by an Afghan war vet saying, if this comes as a surprise to anybody, you need to check on how bad your information flow is. I've never met any single war vet from Afghanistan or someone who worked in the State Department, a good friend of mine worked senior out there, who came back with anything less than basically what we're hearing in these papers. This is totally consistent with what we heard from the WikiLeaks dump several years ago. So we've all known this is going on, even at that time. And I disagree with you, Peter, about like you need diffuse reasons for a coalition. I think that's more the diffuse reasons happen because of mission creep, not because the public is demanding that we have nation building. Public hates nation building, always has, always will, hopefully. But like we've known all
this. I didn't argue
this.
That the public demanded nation building, just that different people have different reasons for going in, and large political coalitions are hard to hold together with a single reason.
But I just don't think that was the political coalition's purpose. The political coalition's purpose at the time was they harbored Osama bin Laden, to hell with them. And which speaks to a declare victory and go home strategy of you harbored this person. Okay, you no longer have the right to have a government. We will knock that out and then see you later. But anyways, that broader point for me about all of that is that if we have known this, everybody has known this in the public who's paid attention to it. People who've served there have known this. The leaders have known this. The internal report, and this came out, what, in 2015, 2016, and then was classified after the fact because the Post was sniffing around. Everybody knows this, and yet our people still die there on a monthly basis. That is horrific to me. Anyone with knowledge there and an ability to put their finger on it, Donald Trump, who campaigned smartly, or at least said on the campaign trail, what the hell are we doing in Afghanistan, and has had the ability. 12 months ago, sorry to rant, I've had a lot of coffee. 12 months ago, there was a sudden spasm. Mitt Romney came out with, an op-ed in the Washington Post. There was all this talk like, oh my God, Trump really has gone too far. And what was that thing that he did that had gone too far? He mused out loud that maybe we should send some of our troops home from Afghanistan. Jesus Christ. That's the thing? The guy is there are
monster.
No other problems? Jesus Christ. So the amount of people willing to allow this default policy that kills people is just monstrous to me. And then the other thing I'll say before switching is that maybe if this is indeed true, as some of us here have suggested, that, you know, government's going to lie about big projects and especially about big war projects. I mean, one kind of a rule of thumb is that if there's a cost estimate on building a subway line or some crap like that, just multiply at least by two, if not three. So if that's baked in, then we should bake in a similar percentage, even more of a percentage, of skepticism / opposition to military intervention. Because if you're going to create structures in which this stuff goes on forever and people die, then maybe that should make you more skeptical about launching forever wars. And speaking of forever wars.
Wow. Do it, Matt. Make the segue happen.
God, I don't know what happened, but suddenly we're having another attempted, at least, war on pornography. I thought we lost and went home on that one. On Friday, four members of Congress, Jim Banks, Vicky Hartzler, Brian Babin, and Freedom Caucus hero Mark Meadows, sent a letter to Attorney General Bill Barr asking him to, quote, declare the prosecution of obscene pornography a criminal justice priority and bring prosecutions against the major producers and distributors of such material. That has since been, and I'm not just bringing this up because the person talking about this loudest is named Matt Walsh, and everybody on Twitter confuses the two. That's not it. It's part of it, but it's not the whole thing. But anyways, one of the paragraphs in these congressmen's or Congresspeople's letter, I'm going to read out loud to Catherine Mangu Ward, the editor of Reason, to see if there's anything that kind of jumps out at you as perhaps factually hyperbolic. As online obscenity and pornography consumption have increased, so too has violence towards women.
Wrong.
Overall.
Keep going.
Overall volume of human trafficking has increased.
Wrong.
And is now the third largest criminal enterprise in the world.
What?
Child pornography is on the rise.
Wrong.
As one of the fastest growing online businesses, with an annual revenue of over $3 billion, the United States has nearly 50% of all commercialized
the child pornography. The visual component websites of this is even more compelling than the audio component, I'm here to say.
Go ahead. Keep going.
Bots have not yet taken, we're keeping it domestic. That's good, right?
America first. Pornography is ubiquitous in our culture, and our children are being exposed at younger ages. In every 10 boys under the age of 18 have seen porn. Children are struggling with pornography addiction. I heard some wrongs in there, Kathy.
Yeah. So, I mean, first, let's go ahead and do the thing, because we should do the thing, which is to say it is bad if children are looking at porn. It is, of course, bad if anyone is being trafficked in any form. I do feel the need to do this bit since, bizarrely, there are humans out there who think that if you are arguing against a ban on porn, you must think that these uncontroversially evil things are good. So, just to start out, I am against things that are uncontroversially evil, like slavery. Ta-da! Okay, now, let's talk about this utterly insane paragraph. I mean, you know, we can just kind of go through the different claims, but I will pick a few out to highlight in particular. The idea that violence against women has increased in the as the availability of pornography has increased is something that has been repeatedly debunked. Steven Pinker and our own Ron Bailey, of course, have written a lot about the declines of all kinds of violence throughout human history. But violence against women in particular has taken an astonishing decline in the same period that pornography has become increasingly available. It used to be totally normal to just sometimes punch your wife if she didn't do a good job with dinner not that long ago. It is utterly insane to think that somehow in that same period where that has gone from being pretty normal to totally forbidden, that like the rise of availability of pornography.
Not just common, but in some ways socially accepted or at least covered up for, where
yes.
police would say, well, that's a domestic matter that we have no say in.
Yes.
Where there was a kind of at least a tacit social acceptance of the idea that husbands could be violent to their wives, that it was a part of that it was an acceptable and even necessary part of a marital relationship.
So at the very least,
Peter,
the correlation
Peter,
is
Peter, are
not
you
there.
Mansplaining wife beating?
He was offering helpful perspective, friends. Then we move on to the overall volume of human trafficking has increased and is now the third largest criminal enterprise in the world. First of all, this is a classic sleight of hand. I want to point it out because if we're going to be fighting about pornography, we're going to hear this a lot. Human trafficking is not the same thing as sex trafficking, first of all. And that conflation is frequently done. And also, the statistics about human trafficking in general and sex trafficking in particular are extremely bad. Some of the people who generated the most commonly cited statistics have since stepped back from those statistics and said that they shouldn't be used the way they're being used for this. See the excellent work of Elizabeth Nolan Brown. Child pornography is on the rise and is one of the fastest growing online businesses with an annual revenue of over $3 billion. What does fastest growing online businesses mean in this context?
Bigger than
no
pets.com.
Idea. If it's starting from a base of like 10 sickos, then like if it's now 300 sickos, I guess that is a fast growing online business, but that's not in any way relevant. And, you know, the total revenue of all online businesses in the last year was something like $500 billion. So I'm struggling to imagine that paid child pornography is like, I don't know, whatever that is, 0.5% of all online revenue. That seems astonishingly high. Does not pass the sniff test. Listen, I can keep going, but every single one of the statistics in this paragraph are stupid, except that porn is more available. That's true. That's accurate. You know, I think, and that's maybe in the end what we should just talk about, is whether that is such a dire outcome that we need to ban and restrict adult behavior. But for those who are going to go look up this paragraph, I urge you to click on the links. The statement has, it's full of links, and they are to the most random garbage you could possibly imagine. Like random Daily Mail articles, some HuffPo thing from 2013. Like, it's a good reminder for everyone. If you see a paragraph that has a bunch of links, it doesn't mean that paragraph is well-sourced. It just means someone can create hyperlinks.
Unless I wrote the paragraph.
Yes.
Catherine. Nick, let's take Matt Walsh. Was it seriously, literally, both, neither, in that his argument is, which he's made, wow, I read 1,000 of his tweets just this morning, is that part of the purpose of law and government is to advance the common good. It is commonly ungood for 7-year-olds to have widespread access to pornography. In what way is he wrong, Nick Gillespie?
Well, first off, I wanted to say I'm looking forward to reading the future postmortem of the failure of the war on porn, and where the insiders in the Trump administration admit that they knew they were full of shit.
The pornography papers?
I think so, yeah.
I think I've read those, and they're different.
It'll be a bracing read. But, you know, Trump campaigned on this back in August of, or July of 2016. He made a big splash of signing on to a pledge that was put forward by a social conservative group about, you know, we need to do everything we can to keep kids away from porn. What's interesting about the Matt Walsh stuff is that it's starting to slide very quickly, and other conservatives away from talking about kids not being able to access porn to the idea that porn is a scourge over all of U.S. society, and it needs to be, you know, kicked out root and branch and things like that. It's an absurd pivot from, you know, it's not surprising that supporters of Donald Trump and social conservatives who have lost every single battle that they've waded into over the past 50 years are now trying to distract people by having a conversation about the immediate and super necessary need, you know, to get rid of online pornography. It's a fake gesture. What is worrying to me, and this is it's very reminiscent of attacks on porn that came out in the 80s. What hasn't happened yet, and that will take this from being a joke to something very serious and a real threat to, I think, freedom of expression, is that we haven't seen the coalition with feminists kick in yet. In the 80s, I was just talking recently with former ACLU head Nadine Strossen, and we were talking about this. And you know what made the anti-porn push in the 80s so powerful was that you had a certain set of feminists as well as religious conservatives really joining arms in order to push this out or to tamp this down. When that happens, if the feminists show up to make common cause with, you know, social conservatives, we got a really big problem.
As a matter of fact, Sohrab Ahmari, and I always mispronounce that, but I've apologized to him in person, had a tweet out like 3 days ago saying, you know, I really look forward to having a future coalition as part of our war on pornography with the feminists, which made us all realize on our recent Slack channel that, oh gosh, he's younger than we thought.
I'm old enough to remember when that coalition already existed once.
Yeah, Jesus.
Twice, really.
Suderman, it's not just the, you know, the people that we identify as superly duperly social cons here who are jumping on this. It's your reformo con pals who also, I mean, didn't Rosso, whatever his name is, from the New York, I know, I can't do it. Didn't he also like advocate banning porn like a year ago? Isn't this, Suderman, at long last, and you're culpable since you live in Washington, isn't this the final resting place, the inevitable, let's say, resting place of these, hey, you know, we have to bend government policies in order to help the family stuff that we've heard from the reformocons since back in the good old Sam's Club days?
I think it is frequently going to be a component of any kind of political ideology that thinks of itself as religiously tinted and motivated by a kind of use by the idea that government should use its power to advance a pro, you know, a sort of traditional conservative family agenda. But this is the thing, is that this is conservatism that isn't limited government conservatism. And the war on porn and the kind of the people who want to wage that war on the right are basically saying that the idea of limited government is a bad idea, that it doesn't, that we shouldn't really take it seriously, that we shouldn't let it be the kind of the big, the lodestar, the guiding light of our project. And you can see J.D. Vance, who is quoted in a First Things piece outlining a bunch of sort of attempting to propose a legislative package that wouldn't get struck down by the courts, that could that could be a first step in the war on porn. But the piece quotes J.D. Vance saying, "We are rightfully skeptical of government overreach." Yes. Yes, you are.
Right.
But there shouldn't be a but after that. But I think we take that skepticism too far, that we're skeptical of even using political power when we have it for ends we think are valuable. That is not an ideology of limited government. Part of the ideology of limited government is to say that when you have power, you should not use it. And in fact, if you do, and the things you do should be to devolve political power away from centralized governmental institutions and out towards individuals and families.
That's a great example of never even, like, don't even read the first part of the sentence before the but,
yeah,
because it's meaningless.
And so there is really a movement on the right at this point, I think, to just give up on the pretense. And it has mostly been a pretense even since the Reagan era, not entirely, but it has often and heavily been a kind of a pretense. It's just a talking point, not an actual reality of governance. But to give up on that idea that limited government, that doing less, that refraining from using power when you have it is a good thing. And the war on pornography is a big part of that. And I would say that even more than that, I would just add, it's also giving up on free speech.
Yeah.
And this is the other big thing, is that the whole idea of free speech is that you defend speech that you find repulsive and repugnant. And if you find pornography repulsive and repugnant, but you also think of yourself as a free speech warrior, you should defend the right of pornography to exist and adults to see and view and spread and talk about pornography. And
but
because that is part of free speech.
But that has never been a part of the conservative movement. They've never been in favor of unfettered free speech, and they've never been in favor of legal pornography. I mean, going back to the 50s and the start of the National Review, you know, they have always wanted to use the government to police adult sexuality. So
there's always been
a
strain, but I do
no,
think
there have been libertarians.
There have been more libertarian kind of fusionist folks, the Chodorovs of the world, who have been better, not always perfect, but who have typically been better about free speech, in particular when it comes to porn, and saying, look, even if I object to it, that's not my business. It's not the government's business. We can deal with this individual.
You didn't find the National Review writing a lot of paeans to why Howl should be published in the late 1950s. In fact, mostly they were appalled by it being degenerate and talking about sodomy and things like that. And so I agree with you, Peter, that this totally reveals, you know, that conservatives in general, and certainly this type of nationalist conservative, they're not interested in limited government. But, you know, I don't know that it's a powerful kind of rebuke to them to say, you know, you're lying about your allegiance to limited government or free speech, because they could rightly say, you know what, we never really cared about that. We want the government to forward the common good as we define it. We want the government to police sexuality and representations of sexuality. And I think when we look at this type of stuff, it is worth looking at the specifics. It's not just a philosophical argument about the role of government, because when it comes from the left, it's not about, well, we believe in free speech, but not in these cases. They don't believe in free speech. They believe in regulating the way that what people are allowed to talk about and how they're able to talk about it. And this is a place to really flex a libertarian vision of limited government, because I think people are kind of getting fed up with the idea that, well, the government, you know, when my guys get in charge, you know, we're going to be able to do whatever we want. I think people are recognizing in the era of Trump, like, that's a bad bet to lay, because you have no idea who's going to be in office and then is going to be grinding you under their heels.
So I want to talk a little bit, though, about the like constitutionalism angle here, because that, like, I've been thinking a lot. You know, we're doing some like end of year and end of decade wrap up content here at Reason, which you should stay tuned for. And one of the things that we've been talking about is, like, have we reached and passed peak free speech? Like, did we have a moment where we genuinely had the most robust free speech protections that we had or are going to have? And I think that's a pretty defensible thesis. And so my question is, like, this thing that Peter is trying to get at, this thing that Peter's trying to get at of, like, conservatives say they like free speech. They say they have in the past done a better job of defending it, if an imperfect one. Nick, you're, of course, right. And it seems to me that, like, the locus of that is constitutionalism, or the idea of being kind of defenders of an original meaning of the Constitution, like holding on to the idea of free speech as expressed in our founding documents, as expressed in the Bill of Rights. And so I wonder if one lens to look at this through is, like, are people just not that hot on defending things that are in the founding documents these days as they once were?
Everyone wants to reinterpret them. I think this question is a good one. And I think Nick's point that an ideological appeal to limited government and, you know, free speech radicalism is not always going to be effective with social conservatives who believe that it's the government's job to help them raise their kids, and not just to help them raise their kids, but to enforce a kind of ideal of the family that everyone, and who even those people who are not social conservatives, should adhere to, which is why there is a practical argument that is fairly straightforward to make that porn bans, as, you know, suggested by Ross Douthat, when, you know, he's my friend, but when he wrote his column in the New York Times, I think it was last year, I responded by saying, look at prohibition, the prohibition of alcohol. What happened? Yes, you did have some reduction in the consumption of alcohol. It wasn't completely ineffective, but you still had an awful lot of alcohol consumption. And the consumption that remained tended to be, the people who were consuming were the most hardcore users. The stuff they were drinking was much more dangerous. And then there was a lot of adjacent crime that was associated with that.
So what you're saying is, when we ban porn, porn gonna get weird.
Porn will get probably more violent, more exploitative, and what you will leave is the kind of, let's say, the casual consumers will probably be the people who will not end up seeing as much.
What's
or
left
any
is going to be the Everclear,
right?
Of porn.
The hardcore people, yes, the hardcore users are what's going to be left, and the porn that's left is going to be I would say the kind that is much more likely to disturb Ross Douthat. And it is going to be associated with violence, criminality, and exploitation much, much more so than it is today in a basically legal environment. And that is a bad thing. And so if you want to protect the people in the porn world, and if you want to keep violence and exploitation and crime out of this, then you have to legalize it and you have to keep it legal.
I'll just add here that, to Nick's point, a lot of people, including Matt Walsh, you know, the libertarian people out there in the world are saying, my God, this is just proof that libertarian or conservatives are not libertarian. That's getting high-fived by all of the conservatives who are passing. They're like, yes, exactly. So, you know, anytime that conservatives offer moments of distinguishing themselves from libertarians, I think it's always good for libertarians to listen. Another thing to add on to what Nick had said, and also in the spirit of the Webathon, which we'll talk about in a moment, it's always fun to go back and look at old Reason covers. And one of the top five, top 10, don't know where you guys are at on this, is the, was it 1980s or even 70s? I think it was the 80s, porn cover of like a wrestling couple underneath the American flag.
Do you think they were wrestling? Is that the word we're using?
Matt, you are so naive. You are so naive, Matt.
Wrestling.
Thank you. But anyways, the two biggest, most recent pushes from the Department of Justice to do, just as Mark Meadows and other freedom fighters are asking now, came under Republican presidents. Ed Meese's very well-ballyhooed war on porn in the 1980s. And then under George W. Bush, there was a big push towards prosecuting porn, which it actually led to some convictions and some prison sentences, but eventually they gave up the effort after a few years during the Obama administration, because you hit up on all kinds of problems of defining this stuff, and what does obscenity mean, which is still vague under the law, and also you have a resource question with the federal government and its cops, and there, I think at long last, isn't a lot of public support for doing this. Let's transition to the webathon. We had so much fun out there, listenerville, answering your questions in our special bonus webathon dispatch, which was videotaped as well, so you could see the love that we have with one another in person. But we had so much fun reading your questions at us that we wanted to do a couple of more here in the final waning hours of our webathon. And also we might still do this in future Reason Roundtable podcasts as necessary, as a semi-recurring event, thinking about it at any rate. But I wanted to get to a couple of emails because they're fun to answer. And first I will go to, but I should mention, of course, go to reason.com, donate. All right. If you like this stuff, go there. And donate. Our webathon's been a pretty great success so far. We're pretty psyched up about it. Okay. Jake emails. First, my city recently voted to ban plastic bags at all city buildings, including at the world's largest airport. I'd like to hear your perspectives on these plastic bag bans that are becoming increasingly popular. On one hand, I believe there's evidence showing that these bag bans effectively reduce plastic waste. On the other, bans also have some health consequences. People basically don't clean their reusable bags, and some of these things backfire, etc. I think that we have someone on this podcast who can speak towards plastic. Okay. Long-fingered one. What's your answer?
You know, I feel like we're not ready to share with the podcast audience that I have creepy hands, so I wish we could remove that.
Next time.
Okay, so I, back in 2015... during the ancient times of plastic bag bans, did a cover story for Reason about this. And I have to say, this move to ban plastic bags at the time seemed like it was moving really fast. Like someone had come up with this idea to do this ill-advised, difficult to implement, symbolic environmental act rather than something actually useful. And it caught on so quickly. And all these celebrities were toting these reusable bags that said, this is not a plastic bag. And it was kind of a thing. And I thought, wow, you know, we barely had a hot minute to say this is a bad idea before these things swept the nation. Obviously, they continue to do so. But plastic bags were nothing compared to how quickly the plastic straw bans went into effect. So I do worry that we have kind of an accelerating, you know, a trajectory for this particular narrow thing, which is these almost entirely symbolic defenses of charismatic megafauna. Like, I like turtles too, man, but the need to do something that is highly visible rather than something that is a good use of people's time and resources, shows everything that is broken about our policy. And the fact that this has been done mostly at the city and then at the state level isn't a coincidence. This is the kind of thing that city councilmen love to like run for re-election on. I commend you to my cover story, though, if you want a point-by-point analysis of every single reason that bag bans are bad, including, as you quite rightly note, the hygienic reasons. But the one tidbit I do want to point out is just that plastic bags are really incredible. And I think that's the other thing that people miss. Like, it was such a cool innovation to figure out how to turn such a tiny, tiny amount of material into something so useful that it instantly became, not instantly, actually, it took a minute, but that it quite rapidly became ubiquitous. And that we found all these other uses for this thing that weren't even part of the original design. It really seems like a shame to me and a bad sign for civilization, frankly, that we would be such ungrateful wretches in the face of an incredible innovation like that, and that we would ban it rather than looking for ways to encourage people to use it more responsibly.
Jake also asks a question that I'll throw at Peter. Trump recently finalized some federal regulations that hospitals are now required to make public all the prices they negotiate with insurers and health plans starting in 2021. This appears to be an excellent policy by the federal government that actually frees the marketplace and encourages capitalism by protecting consumers rather than restricting it. What do you think? Is there a downside to this that I am missing? Peter Suderman.
So in general, price posting and price transparency in marketplaces is good. There is a particular problem in healthcare and even more specifically within hospitals. Pricing within hospitals prices kind of don't exist. And there's this, like, if you talk to hospital administrators and people who work on the billing side, there's some people who kind of know narrowly how prices work, say, for a specific field or practice, you know, or a group that's working within a hospital. But almost no one even understands the entire system and attempts to kind of regulate this stuff at the state level. There were quite a few, there were states that had mandatory kind of price equalization schemes throughout the 1970s and 1980s. And they ended up going away in part because neither the legislators nor the hospitals themselves ever really understood them. But the legislators eventually realized that the large hospitals understood them best. And the small hospitals were constantly complaining about this. And it just ended up being a lobbying free-for-all, because that's what happens when you have government that controls prices. So I like the general thrust of this regulation in some ways. I get the spirit of it, but I'm not sure that this particular rule is going to work. One is that the idea is to drive down prices through a combination of shame and competition. So if prices are all posted, then you can see, oh, this payer is paying a lot more than this other one. And the hospital might feel some pressure, therefore, to equalize those prices by bringing down the very high rate to the low rate. But what might end up happening is the reverse, where the hospital just says everyone is now paying the much higher rate. That could be bad for patients, for overall health spending, and for government healthcare spending. The other thing is that there are some free speech concerns here that I don't think are completely illegitimate. Yes, the hospitals are have some self-interest in this, but this is compelled speech. And compelled speech, especially that isn't obviously going to give typical, you know, sort of average patients really useful and actionable information, because this is not like you're going to walk in and it's going to be like the menu on a McDonald's. That's not how this is going to work. There's going to be a bunch of mandatory regulatory, federal disclosure sheets that you're going to have to sort through. These prices are going to get basically sort of uploaded to HHS or something like that. It's not going to be a sort of, oh, you can just call and get prices and it's going to be easy to shop around. I don't think we're going to get there. And so while I would like to say I think this is a very good idea, and while I like price posting and price transparency in general, I am reserving judgment on this particular regulation because attempts to do this through federal mandates often don't work the way they are supposed to. In general, when you sort of look at this, another sign of how far we are from any kind of meaningful, functional market within the healthcare world.
Good question. Good answer. Finally, I'll read one from Charles. It's directed to all of us, but I'm going to redirect it towards Nick for reasons that will soon become clear. Charles says, former right-wing evangelical who has made the transition to atheist liberal over the last 15 years, while looking for rational views to balance out my own, not willing to listen to the party that believes gays cause hurricanes, I stumbled upon His Holiness, St. Nicholas of Gillespie, on an episode of Real Time with Bill Maher. Since then, I've used reason as a counterpoint to my own and to keep my views in check. So the question is, what are your favorite non-libertarian podcasts or writers that you feel keep you in check or challenge your positions, Nick Gillespie? And what views do you hold that you would say are the least libertarian?
I like to read Jacobin magazine a lot. I like to read clearest, most ideologically different, I think, positions. So Jacobin is a socialist, an unapologetically, unabashedly socialist organization, and their analyses proceed from those kinds of priors. So I find that I find it interesting to see that. I also like to read National Review because for similar reasons, and I think for many good, understandable reasons, for a long time we have pretended that conservatives and libertarians are thickly entwined, and I don't think that was ever true, and I think it's getting more and more obvious in different ways. So those are two places that I look.
Say the phrase thickly entwined ever again.
Yeah, no.
At least save it for a day when we're not talking about pornography.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, we can't get away from pornography is everywhere. And then in terms of the least libertarian views, I don't know. I don't really, you know, I mean, other than that, like, I, you know, I don't really care about so many things. And I don't, you know, but that's like very libertarian, I think, where I don't get bent out of shape over individual decisions people make. I like to talk about them in terms of art. And maybe that's, I would say my aesthetics are often counter, my likes rather, in terms of when we're talking about particular books or movies or music. I have a very kind of non-judgmental take on things, and I don't care particularly about tradition or issues of greatness, which I think a lot of libertarians often defer to, a kind of idea that tradition and winnowing out of things over years has made something great. Like, appeals to greatness when it comes to aesthetics, I find very uninteresting.
Charles, I'll just volunteer that there's too much to choose from with my own least libertarian beliefs out there. But the one that readers and listeners like to remind me of the most is a column I wrote about 10 years ago called "Why I Prefer French Healthcare." So let the raspberries.
Which you wrote during the thick of the Obamacare debate.
Two C's also on that thick as well.
Ooh, Matt, you're so hip with the youths. That was great.
Nick just said that like no, 30 no, seconds but ago, but you weren't listening.
The thick with two C's is good.
Stop it. All right, speaking of cultural
of
references
you.
That I won't get.
I assumed you wouldn't get it.
Let's start with our end-o podcast. What the hell have you been consuming? Peter Suderman. You go first.
I watched Knives Out, which was clever but irritating and kind of smugly self-satisfied in a lot of ways. But the one I want to talk about today that you, Matt Welch, I think will really appreciate is that I have been consuming Randy Newman studio albums from the 1970s, which
I did not even realize. So alone.
I'm sorry, Catherine.
Are you talking about like Sail Away?
So I had experienced, Good Old Boys in particular, I had basically didn't realize that Randy Newman existed before his film scores. And a friend of mine, who is a listener of this podcast, Connor Friedersdorf, came over and we were listening to music. And he was like, Peter, have you ever heard this by Randy Newman? Have you ever? And I was like, I don't like grok Andy Newman or Randy Newman. Like, it's just not I grew up in a household that was like, my mom was sort of, you know, more into like kind of hippie rock, and my dad was on the folk side. So it was, you know, Bob Dylan versus Janis Joplin, really, in my, like, that was the parental musical battle, which may say something about how I became the way I am. But like, Randy Newman just sort of never crossed in front of me, and I'd never spent any time listening to him. But I had a great experience just like sitting and listening to music, to a bunch of his albums with a good friend. I've like recently sort of put together a nice little sound system in my basement. And part of this was enabled by streaming music and by the fact that he didn't have to, he could just sort of assume that I had access to virtually all recorded, you know, sort of modern recorded music, and that it wasn't we have to go through your collection and we have to have things, or he has to bring records over. And so there's really kind of like nice little learning moment about culture, and also a sort of social moment in which a friend was able to show me and sort of something and explain what it was he liked about it, and sort of and let me sort of experience his one of his favorite artists that I probably would not have paid much attention to if not for him and if not for the existence of streaming music services.
I think I can speak for Nick Gillespie here confidently when I say there is exactly one, maybe two Randy Newman songs that are worth your time, but certainly at the top of the list or near it is Short People.
His scores for, particularly for Toy Story, the original Toy Story, is fantastic. But Peter, I think, doesn't he define smug self-satisfaction as a recording artist, where he's just making fun of the rubes from his hideaways and redoubts in the Hollywood Hills?
I think there's a fair amount of that. That is a reasonable criticism. The timbre of his voice and the kind of just the general vibe of it in the 70s studio albums, I think, really goes a long way towards making that work. When we listened to his most recent studio album, like I couldn't take it because it was just musical theater. It was just everything, Dark Matter. I felt like it was, you know, Phantom of the Opera or something. I mean, I don't like listening to musical theater. It's not that I think it's bad or
my
something.
My brain booted back up upon the words Phantom of the Opera. Yeah. And I was like, wait, what?
Yeah, but it's just not my vibe.
Fun fact about Randy Newman, had a huge influence, certainly on musicians and music critics, if nothing else, in the early 70s. One person who decided, after a very long and successful recording career, that in which voices and like prettiness of voice was part of it. One person who decided, I need to start singing like Randy Newman in 1975 was Brian Wilson, and for about of the Beach Boys, and for about 2 years, in addition to swelling up to the size of a human manatee and taking every drug known to mankind, especially cheeseburgers, he sang every song like Randy Woman. Go listen to "Love Is a Woman" and listen to a person with a sweet voice trying to sound as crappy as Randy Newman does. Nick, speaking of crappy, what have you been consuming?
I watched the series finale of Silicon Valley last night on HBO. It was 50-minute double episode. I think Silicon Valley is a fantastic show. It's a tribute to Mike Judge being able, going back to the 80s, to capture the zeitgeist of each successive decade, one way or the other. I think it's still filtering through people's screens and whatnot, so I won't do any spoiler alerts. But the final episode, which I want to watch again because I'm not sure exactly what it means, but the series in the end is kind of a meditation on the failure of the internet to transform the world and to liberate us in the ways that we expected it to. And I think in that way, I would draw a parallel to The Venture Brothers, a great show that was on Adult Swim for years. And it was really, both of them are kind of meditations on the failure to create the world that we hoped we would be inhabiting by now. And it's really, really good stuff. Silicon Valley is one of the most acutely observed satires, not just of Silicon Valley and the tech industry, but I think of American expectations in general. So that's what I was watching.
Catherine Mangu Ward.
My what I'm consuming is also another Webathon shout out, because I got a note from a reader, a longtime reader named Neil Schuster, Rabbi Neil Schuster, who just said, hey, I've been listening to the stuff that you read, and I think you might like this book. And I went and bought it, and he was right. I like this book. So this segment is really paying dividends for me. Rabbi Schuster also seems to be a recent donor. So that's pretty awesome. The book is This Is How You Lose the Time War, which I think we can all agree sounds like a book I would like. It is by Amal El-Motar and Max Gladstone, and it is an epistolary novel of time travel between some post-humans, and it's really good. It's not, like, the highest literature, but it is super readable. It's a good concept, and the cover design is pretty snazzy. So This Is How You Lose the Time War, from a reader. Thank you, Neil.
In defense of the internet and its abilities to still give us some wonderments over the years, and I'm not talking about the backup band for Brian Wilson's solo projects.
Are you going to Pornhub and you're doing a callback to the war on pornography, Matt?
I am. No, I saw this thing. It came through my Twitter feed, actually by a great journalist named Michael Scott Moore, who was kidnapped by Somali pirates for several months not long ago. But anyways, there's a website called The Deep Sea, done by a guy named Neil Agarwal, and get there, neal.fun/, is that right, Catherine? Deep -C, or just do a Google search on the same thing. But anyways, this thing is, you just scroll down. It starts with, you know, there's the sky and there's the ocean on the top of it, and the ocean's kind of light blue, and you keep scrolling down, and the gimmick is that it shows you the deepest known points for various animals. who have been there and what they look like, what they're named, and some facts about them. And it is terrifying. It is absolutely, I was having panic attacks. I was reaching for my Valium, if I had any, by the time you get down into the pitch black, and then you just keep going down, and suddenly near the end, spoiler alert, there's a submarine with actual humans trying to go down in like the Marianas Trench or some damn place. And just these phenomenal animals that swallow other animals that are five times as big as they are. And there's zombie worms, and everything is just super, super heavy metal. It is awesome. It'll waste 10 to 15 minutes of your work day. So that's worth it.
I want to read this science fiction novel with zombie worms, a submarine, and everything super heavy metal.
Right?
That's a good
no,
point.
Actually, as I tweeted back after Matt shared this incredible weird internet thing with us, I already knew everything in this graphic because my children are big fans, or were big fans, of the show The Octonauts, in which a wacky crew of vaguely humanish animal anime creatures are always diving into the midnight zone in their submarines.
That's awesome.
There is a great South Park episode where James Cameron is going deep, deep, deep into the ocean to lower the bar, to raise the bar on popular culture. And deep, deep down in the bottom of the ocean floor, James Cameron is puttering around, but they keep finding Randy Newman, of all people.
Can't be true. Is that true?
It's absolutely true. I'll send you a link, Matt, that you can put in the show notes. But it's like down at the below where anything lives anymore, there's still Randy Newman puttering around going like do-to-do-to-do. It's quite a funny
actually bit. Now that you mentioned that, I remember.
Guys.
Oh, that makes my day. What?
We've become like the levels of like recursive self-parody here are so high. Listen, we have to sign off before we end the universe.
Fan service. Thank you for listening to the Reason Roundtable. Two last show notes. Go to reason.com podcasts to subscribe, not just to this, but you already do, but to the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie and to the Soho Forum debates. And also, these are the last hours. Please donate to our annual webathon. Allow us to keep doing this and do better and more and deeper and more recursive Mobius strips of bad Randy Newman analogies and so on. Thank you. Goodbye.
This podcast is brought to you by Unobtainium.